Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from John Russell and Anne Ball. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, a media organization in Somalia reported last week that Somali government forces beat and detained a record number of journalists last year. That information left some people wondering if the government is restricting investigation of its security record before elections later this year. For years, the militant group Al-Shabaab was accused of targeting Somali journalists. The number of killings has decreased, although two journalists were among those killed in a bombing last year. Now, media say they face a new danger: government forces. State security forces detained 38 journalists in Somalia in 2019. That information comes from Abdulai Ahmed Mumin, Secretary General of the Somali Journalists Syndicate. He says most were detained while reporting on bombings or militant attacks. Some media workers were reporting on corruption. The government is not allowing journalists to report, Mumim said. Officials rarely report the number of victims from incidents like a recent truck bombing, which killed around 90 people. Mumin's report says that in most cases, detained journalists are not charged and are released after hours or days. Last year, 37 journalists were beaten, shot at, or threatened at gunpoint in Somalia, mostly by state security forces, the report said. Somalia's police spokeswoman, the Interior Minister, and Information Ministry spokesman did not answer requests for comment. There is no public database of attacks and bombings in Somalia. The country's citizens usually hear about attacks through the media. However, while the size of bombings is increasing, journalists say news coverage is decreasing. Farhan Mohammed Hussein is a reporter for Radio Kulmiye, a privately owned station. Hussein said he was arrested 3 times last year and twice the year before. Once police blindfolded him and beat him with their guns, he said. Another time, they destroyed his camera. Hussein added, "Many people see you as an enemy when they see you have a camera. Reporters are victims of the government, which was supposed to work with them." He also said that journalists have been banned from parliament and ignored by spokesmen who only release official statements on social media. Abdulai Ahmed Mumin confirmed the ban. He added that the upper legislature is considering a bill to further restrict media freedom. Nimco Mohammed Bashir is director of the privately owned Rajo Television Network. She said the government restricts reporting in a way that political killings never had. Bashir said that government officials openly tell you no covering stories of blasts. After she reported news of one bombing on Facebook, she said, police came to her home to arrest her and threatened her family. Amin Ambulance is often the only source about deaths or injuries from militant attacks. Dr. Abdiqadir Adin is the head of the privately run service. He told the Reuters news agency that in April, government officials asked the service to stop releasing numbers of dead and wounded. Adin noted that the government also tried to restrict emergency medical vehicles from explosion sites. Government officials did not answer Reuters' requests for comment.
Japan has changed its plan for cleaning up the Fukushima nuclear plant. The change further delays the removal of used nuclear fuel that has remained in cooling pools since the 2011 disaster. The removal process is difficult because of high radiation levels and other risks. But the government and the plant's owner, Tokyo Electric Power, or TEPCO, are aiming to complete the task within 30 to 40 years. After the earthquake and tsunami, more than 4,700 fuel rod units remain at the three melted reactors and two surviving reactors. The fuel rods present a high risk because their storage pools are uncovered. If another major disaster were to cause a loss of water, the fuel rods could melt, releasing radiation. Their removal was first planned in 2018, but it has now been postponed for up to 10 years in order to reduce radiation and to clear other waste. TEPCO has been unable to release 1.2 million tons of water kept in nearly 1,000 tanks at the Fukushima Center. It is feared that the release of radioactive water will harm fishing and agriculture in the area. The plant can only store up to 1.37 million tons of water, and the amount of water is growing by 170 tons every day because it is used to cool the melted fuel inside the reactors. At this rate, TEPCO says the plant will run out of storage space by the summer of 2022. Japan's government recently wrote a proposal to release the water after treatment. The water is still somewhat radioactive, but TEPCO says further treatment can remove all but radioactive tritium to levels acceptable for release. Experts say tritium is not harmful to humans in small amounts and has been regularly released from nuclear plants around the world. The biggest difficulty for Japan is the removal of an estimated 880 tons of melted fuel from Fukushima's three severely damaged reactors. The amount is six times larger than what was found after the 1979 Three Mile Island partial meltdown in the United States. A robotic arm was developed for the task. The removal will begin with just a spoonful at first. The fuel will then be carefully measured and studied under International Atomic Energy Agency instructions. Japan hopes to slowly expand the process of removal with new methods. However, the country has yet to develop a plan to dispose of the highly radioactive melted fuel and other waste from the reactors. TEPCO and the government say they plan to build a storage area for radioactive waste from Fukushima. But finding a place and getting public support will be difficult. I'm John Russell.
One of the largest public school systems in the United States is about to launch a new policy. Later this month, students attending Fairfax County Public Schools, FCPS, can take time off from school for civic activities. Fairfax County is in Northern Virginia, just outside Washington, D.C. Beginning January 21st, FCPS will give students one excused absence each school year for what it calls civic engagement activities. Students must be in grades 7 to 12, meaning most are 12 to 18 years old. FCPS School Board Chair Karen Corbett Sanders told VOA the idea for the policy comes from a rise in student activism. After 17 people died in a shooting at a Florida high school in 2018, students around the country protested gun violence. Some of the demonstrations were in Fairfax County. Corbett Sanders notes, at the time, school officials wanted to give students a chance to express their concerns.
We gave flexibility to students to have their voices heard and to express their concerns about safety and security in their schools.
There is no defined list of approved activities. The choice is up to the students. However, they might be participating in marches, sit-in protests, or taking time to talk with local or national lawmakers. Corbett Sanders says living just outside Washington means that many FCPS students are knowledgeable about national politics. But she says students are not limited to going into the city to become involved in the civic process.
We have students who go down to Richmond, which is where our state legislature is. We have students who have been engaged in climate change rallies here in Fairfax County. And so I think what we're seeing is that young people in general want to be engaged in the civic process, the policy process.
Corbett Sanders says she has already heard from parents who say their children plan to attend the yearly March for Life in Washington. The event is held to protest the 1973 U.S. Supreme Court ruling on a woman's right to end her pregnancy. In years past, if students attended the March for Life, they would have been given an unexcused absence. The school system's new policy ties together action and what students learn in their classrooms. Civic engagement is something that is emphasized in government classes, notes Corbett Sanders. The FCPS policy may find a supporter in U.S. Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts. In a year-end report on the federal court system, Roberts called for an increase in civic awareness in the country. "We have come to take democracy for granted, and civic education has fallen by the wayside," he said. Meira Levinson is a professor of education at Harvard University. "The policy is a good idea," she told VOA, "because when students grow up, they will have civic rights and responsibilities."
And so this policy is good at recognizing that and the importance of preparing young people for that and of honoring their civic participation.
But she adds, giving students just one day off to engage in civic action is only a start. It cannot be the only thing that they do to support civic learning.
They also need to provide coursework. They need to support student activism in schools. They need to provide examples of people who are civically engaged in all sorts of ways.
I'm Ann Ball.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Grover Cleveland was elected President of the United States in 1884. He was the first Democratic Party candidate to win a presidential election in almost 28 years. Grover Cleveland defeated James Blaine, a senator from the Republican Party. The election was very close. Many Republicans did not vote for their own candidate. They voted for Cleveland instead. They believed he was honest and that Blaine was not. Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe tell us about the presidency of Grover Cleveland.
Cleveland began his administration by announcing that he would reduce waste in the government. He would make government more like business. He said he would support reforms to let ability, not politics, decide who would get government jobs. Democratic Party leaders were quick to protest. They explained to Cleveland that the party owed jobs to those who had worked for his victory. Cleveland had to compromise. He permitted about 80,000 government jobs to be taken from Republicans and given to Democrats. This left 12,000 jobs. These would be given to people who did the best on government examinations. Cleveland's decision angered Republican reformers who had voted for him. They accused him of surrendering to the leaders of the Democratic Party.
On other issues, however, Cleveland refused to compromise. He opposed government economic aid to any industrial group. He vetoed a bill giving aid to farmers whose crops had failed. And he vetoed another bill giving more money to men who had served as soldiers during America's Civil War of the 1860s. The president also showed his independence by investigating gifts of public land that the government had made to the railroad, wood, and cattle industries. He found that many of these land grants were made illegally. He got back much of the land. He opened it to settlers.
President Cleveland signed into law two bills he believed would improve government. One was the Electoral Count Act. It set new rules for counting the electoral votes of the states. It would prevent future disputes over presidential elections, like the one in 1876. The other bill changed the list of officials who could become president if the president and vice president died or were removed from office. First on the list, after the vice president, was the Secretary of State. Congress changed this law again in 1947, and there have been four amendments since then. Today, the Speaker of the House of Representatives would succeed the vice president as president. Then would come the president pro tempore of the Senate, and then the Secretary of State.
Grover Cleveland approved a bill giving the government control over the cost of railroad transportation. The bill was called the Interstate Commerce Act. It limited the amount of money railroads could demand from people who needed to travel or transport their goods. The law established the idea that the government could control industries when necessary for the public good. President Cleveland also was concerned about a growing number of labor disputes that took place in the United States in the late 1800s. He proposed that Congress create a labor committee to help settle the disputes.
Congress failed to act on this proposal, but its lack of action did not stop the rise of a labor organization that had been formed a few years earlier. The group soon would become the most important labor union in the United States. It was the American Federation of Labor, or AFL. Led by Samuel Gompers, the AFL was different from earlier labor groups. It did not try to put all workers into one union. Instead, it tied together a number of different unions and gave them general leadership.
The AFL was different in other ways. It did not oppose the economic system of capitalism. It said only that labor should get more of the earnings of capitalism. The AFL also opposed extremists who used labor protests to change the social system. What the AFL called for were things workers wanted immediately: higher wages, a shorter work day, better working conditions. One of its first demands was an 8-hour work day. This demand led to a number of strikes and protests throughout the country.
The most serious incident took place in Chicago's Haymarket Square. More than 1,000 union supporters went to a meeting there, organized by an extremist. They stood calmly and listened to speeches. Just before the meeting ended, someone threw a bomb into a group of policemen. The bomb exploded with a blinding flash. 7 policemen were killed. The other policeman began shooting at the crowd. Some people in the crowd fired back. When it was all over, 10 persons had been shot to death. 50 others were hurt. The incident set off a wave of fear and anger across the country. The public demanded action against union extremists. The Haymarket Square violence slowed the growth of organized labor in the United States for many years. It would be some time before labor became a powerful force in national events.
In the spring of 1886, President Cleveland announced that he was to be married. The ceremony took place in the White House. A few months later, President Cleveland and the First Lady went to New York City for the official ceremony welcoming the Statue of Liberty. The statue was a gift to the people of the United States from the people of France. It represented the alliance between their two countries during America's war for independence from Britain. The statue was the creation of French artist Frédéric Auguste Bartholdi. He decided to make a statue that would represent freedom, a statue of liberty. He said it should stand on an island in New York Harbor. There, he said, it would welcome all who came to America through that gateway.
Bartholdi decided to make a copper statue in the image of a woman, Lady Liberty. High above her head, she would hold a torch of freedom to light the world. The statue's face was the face of Bartholdi's mother. The artist asked French engineer Gustave Eiffel to build a steel support to hold the heavy statue. Eiffel was the man who later built the Eiffel Tower in Paris. The statue was built in France. Then the pieces were sent across the Atlantic Ocean. It was rebuilt in New York.
Grover Cleveland and his wife were not the only Americans to attend the Statue of Liberty ceremonies in 1886. Thousands of people crowded onto ships in the harbor to watch the great event. Thousands of others crowded the shorelines around the harbor. Everyone cheered wildly when a signal was given and a huge cloth fell from the statue. Lady Liberty stood holding her torch high for freedom. Under her feet were the broken chains of tyranny. Below the statue was a poem. It called to the poor and oppressed people of the world. It told them to come to America to find a land of hope and freedom.
Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shores. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed, to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door.
The Statue of Liberty was a great success. It was one of the great engineering wonders of its time, and it filled Americans with pride in their tradition of freedom and openness to people from all lands.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.